Thank you. Be seated. Final cause of Richards versus Newhouse. Justice Gonzalez has voluntarily recused. The court is now ready to hear argument from the petition.
May it please the court. Mr. Jimmy Posner and Ms. Rose Rand will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Posner will open with the first 12 minutes.
May it please the court. This is, as we view it, another hindsight look into the collapse of the First City National Bank as it stopped in the 80s. In 1976, Dr. Newhouse, a well-known valley doctor, and his wife created several trusts. The trust, the principal asset in the trust, as the court knows from reading the brief, was stock in the McAllen State Bank. And in 1982, that stock was exchanged at the time the First City was doing what? For First City stock. The court may not be able to take judicial notice of it, but it is a fact. Starting in the mid-80s, the First City started having considerable difficulties, economic difficulties. And cratered along about 87. Though there is evidence in this case that their investment advisors told them they should have sold the stock to the trustees. I did not. And of course it ultimately sold for just a fraction of its value at the time of the exchange in 82. There are two trustees. One of them is Miss Gracie Newhouse, the daughter of the deceased Dr. Newhouse, and she is represented by Rose Rainier here, and John Lewis is about. I operate for and on behalf of Morris Atlas and his law firm, and Bob Schwartz in the firm, who was appointed in 85 as a trustee. There is a difference between the position of the parties. As to the law firm and to Mr. Atlas and Mr. All of those connected with the firm, the allegation is made that by their sitting on their hands and being advisors to the bank and advisors to the estate, that there was self-dealing or conflicts in their case that made their whole participation bad news. There were no such claims, of course, could have been made and are not made about Gracie. It is claimed that the statute that you have up here and the trust instrument don't protect her either. In 1983, the legislature amended the property code and passed 113.003. While the history is sparse as to why they did it, the case law seems to me abundantly clear. In 1981, I believe 82, when this court refused the writ, in Jewett versus Capital National Bank, it was held that language in a trust instrument, or sculptory language, protecting the trustee, similar to what we had in this trust instrument, would not protect if he just totally sat on their hands. And they sent that summary judgment back for a trial. This statute, of course, eliminated that question. It authorized the trustees to retain property without liability, without trying to sell it, without diversifying it. But the language of diversification in that statute is very important. The Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and held that that statute really didn't mean what it says. That what it was impacted against the common law, therefore it must be construed strictly. I have no particular quarrel in statutory changes in trust law or any statutory law are to be construed, if they're in derogation, strictly. But construing that strictly, that statute, there was no basis for the Court of Appeals to conclude, I can't understand it, that that added that last part of it, any property that constitutes initial trust corpus, or that is added to the trust, that added to the trust, the Court of Appeals held that had to mean gift. It didn't mean changes, alterations, exchanges that occurred here. I just don't want to be too pejorative. But the truth of it is that that statute in and of itself, without any other statute, the court will read the first item. The trustee may retain, without regard to diversification. Diversification is exactly what happened in this case. I mean, the stock was diversified by exchange. And on its face, it did what the statute authorized, but that weren't enough. At the same time in 84, the legislature added the additions to the trust property, which this was under that definition. And as we see it, there can't be any attempt to say it was ambiguous or it wasn't clear on what it meant, and then go back and reach out into the thin air and grab a test that if you know that attitude, the trust only means gifts.
If Jewett were the law, you'd lose.
Beg your pardon?
If Jewett were the law, you'd lose.
Well, you didn't announce that either, but
no, if that were the law, that's completely contrary.
Your Honor, and you were in the legislature when this was passed.
Well, that's what I want to know. Is there any legislative history that suggests, as your brief does, that the purpose of the statutory change was to overrule Jewett?
Well, that is what we argue, because Jewett had just been decided, just been done already. But in the state bar, who proposed the new code, as you are familiar, they just said there's no substantive change propounded by this section. And I quite agree that that's correct. There is a substantive change. This was merely intended to make clear what a settlor can do or could do in the trust document.
So are you saying that the only legislative history suggests that the statutory change was not intended to overrule Jewett?
No. The only thing about the legislative history, they said there's no substantive changes to be made. Now, to say that the Jewett case was the substantive law of Texas, a Court of Appeals, dictum, NRE, I have a hard time with that, but I believe that is the reason. And whether it is or not, it clearly is a statute that eliminates that kind of consideration. Now, the other section, the section of the trust that also permit the retention of assets without any liability on the trustees is this section 5, which furnished copies of it to the court and independent of it, and we'd like to leave that with the court if it cares to have them. But the truth of it is, that statute very clearly permits the retention. I will concede to Justice Doggett that that was muchly like the one in Jewett, in which they had wide latitude, and they just sat on their hands and didn't do anything with the corpus of the trust. But they Court of Appeals seized upon the last section. No trustee shall be liable for negligence or error of judgment, but shall be liable only for his willful misconduct or personal dishonesty. The claim of the Court of Appeals, without any specific pleading whatsoever, determined that willful misconduct was something that had, didn't really come out to say that the things they had done were willful misconduct. Because as we view it, the statute and the trust keep that from being, by definition, willful misconduct. There's no effort to define misconduct by the trial court, by the Court of Appeals, and before this court. We did cite some cases that treat misconduct of this type of default, willful default, as being intending to purposely hurt the corpus of the trust. And that's not here.
Mr. Kronzer, if this First City stock that you say mutated into the McAllen National Bank stock mutated into the First City stock, if that wasn't the initial trust corpus, you have no objection or no disagreement that the prudent investor standard would otherwise apply, do you?
Well, I would say that if that statute that we put up there a minute ago were not there, and adding to the trust only includes gifts of third-party sources, the doctor and his wife were alive when the exchange occurred. So when the exchange between the stock, I would say, Your Honor, reluctantly, that I'd have a bigger problem if I can go that way. But I guess I better shut down and let Ms. Randall talk.
Let me have a few questions, not to count against the time of your co-counsel. Are you saying that the plaintiffs in this case have not made any pleading that there was willful misconduct as understood personally and purposely intentionally, or just that you have negated that pleading as a matter of law in your summary judgment program?
Now, may I speak to that? What we say, assume it is our burden to negate a willful misconduct when pled even generally, because there are only specifics famed willful misconduct, for the failure to sell and our alleged self-dealing and conflicts of the law.
But we've always held that intent is a peculiarly subjective thing, which usually has to be resolved by a finder of fact. So let's just assume it's your burden to negate.
But there's no definition by the Court of Appeals at all of what is willful misconduct. They are saying, so well, that as to the trust instrument, it was our burden to negate, presumably, Mr. Chief Justice, any kind of conceivable misconduct, whether pled or not. And what we say about 166A is when they allege specific, as they did, and we negate that, then we don't have to go out into the Never Land and negate that we stole and went down the river. We didn't. And I might add that in closing, there are two important aspects of that. In their papers on the summary judgment, they stated, quote, there is no fact dispute here. And lastly, when the trial, we were moving for a partial summary judgment, that's after the same general terms were used. The trial judge granted our partial summary judgment as to the failure to have sold or tried to sell this stock. And whereupon, in that transcript, the beneficiaries, through their lawyers, stood up and told the judge, said, Judge, we want to be able to appeal this thing. What you have done reaches every aspect of our case. And that I can give you the pages that we cited it, but it's in the transcript of the proceedings on the summary judgment. And he says, you have effectively disposed of each issue. There is no issue for the jury. Now, in the light of that, Your Honor, and in the light of the fact we did negative all aspects of their claims, we don't have an additional burden to go forward and negative any supposed theory just because willful misconduct encompasses a large degree of
One other question, hopefully can be answered shorter. Under your reading of Section 113, as added in the code, is there anything left of the prudent investor standard or the general statutory standard of liability for a trustee for anything other than selling items in a trust? I mean, if adding to a trust means bringing new things in.
Not if the trustees are not appropriating funds or invading the corpus or that kind of embezzlement or self-dealing. It's intended. See, and that's what this case is about. How far can a settlor go in exculpating a friend or somebody he wants to be his trustee or the legislature from potential liability by an unhappy beneficiary? And that's what the bottom line issue is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear the remainder of the petitioner's argument.
May it please the court. Mr. Ponder left the podium at a very good point for me to bring in what my position is on this case. I do represent the Gracie Newhouse Richards, Doc Newhouse's daughter. She was one of the original trustees in the case. In this matter, there are differences in the pleading. The only pleadings, as they affect my client, are limited solely to the alleged wrong conduct of not selling stock. And that's the only limitation of the pleading as to my client. That's the only allegation. In that regard, Mr. Cronzer left the podium with a statement regarding how far can a settler go insofar as limiting the liability of the trustees. There's no question in reviewing the trust document that Doc Newhouse had a tremendous amount of faith and trust in his daughter to execute these trusts. The trust document itself created family trust for 9 family members, including the children and grandchildren of the settlers. Mrs. Newhouse also was one of the beneficiaries of the trust also. She was responsible for taking the trust assets and taking them in an undivided 1/9 as to each beneficiary.
You say Mrs. Newhouse, you mean Mrs. Richards was one of them?
Yes, Your Honor. She goes by Grace Newhouse or Grace Newhouse Richards. That's correct. One and the same. And in reviewing the trust document, it's very clear that the settlers wanted to give as much leeway as possible to her in executing these trusts. The trust document goes on for pages and pages, and I won't go through those detailed pages with the court of the powers and authority granted to her. They are all express powers to her, giving her authority and power. It also...
But granting the authority is not inconsistent with imposing liability for misuse of it.
That's correct, Your Honor. It goes on and it indicates that insofar as restrictions on her conduct, that there it negates the obligation. There are pages of provision quoting, there's no obligation to convert any property. There is no obligation to dispose of property. Investments may be of a wasting nature. Property may be retained with a view to possible increase in value. Trustees shall have as wide latitude in retention as an individual would in retaining their own assets. The trustees shall have full power and authority to hold, manage any and all properties in the trust estate. And that hold and managing language is very important because the trust held these properties on the stock that's an issue. The trust document clearly has no provision where the trustee is required to sell the stock. It grants the trustee the power to sell. However, there's no requirement to sell the stock. And furthermore, the trust document clearly and unambiguously even states that there's no requirement to sell the stock, even if there is a decline in the value, which once again, factually, those are the only facts in which they're claiming any wrongdoing in this matter. The issue gets back to whether or not the family trust provisions and the trust code provisions that are applicable allow Ms. Newhouse to do what she did in this particular case. Once again, there's no evidence of any willful misconduct. And that is a matter that was never brought up at the trial court. And that's something that, in reviewing the file, that's something that the Court of Appeals latched onto. Insofar as willful misconduct, misconduct is the doing of a conduct that's not authorized or not allowed. The trust term clearly authorized her to do these things. They clearly indicated that she had the authority to do that, which is what she did. How can there be willful misconduct or actions and powers specifically authorized or provided by the settlers to the trustee?
What was the evidence that they were advised to sell the stock? Were the advisors referred to in the trust instrument?
Not in the trust instrument, no.
Did they retain advisors? I didn't quite understand.
Actually, the trust document itself allows the trustees full authority to obtain, retain, hire any type of advisors, attorneys, accountants. She had full authority to do
that. Well, was that done? Is my question.
There, as far as summary judgment evidence, there is nothing that is included in the summary judgment evidence as to that issue. And there's no allegations of negligence in the retaining of any outside advice. There's no allegations of that whatsoever.
Is there summary judgment evidence that the failure of the trustees to follow advice of the investment advisor cost the trust $1 million?
No, Your Honor, there's no such summary judgment whatsoever.
There was no controverting summary judgment evidence tendered?
That's correct.
The only summary judgment evidence was on behalf of your clients and Mr. Pronger's clients. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Including the proving up and proper authentication of the trust document.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott Rogers.
May I please the court? At the outset, before I get into my argument, I do want to take issue with counsel for Ms. Richards. There was some summary judgment evidence. In fact, there was an affidavit of Vernon Newhouse Jr., which contained a number of documents, including a letter from Mr. C.C. McLean. And Mr. McLean was a partner in the Atlas and Hall law firm, was a trustee at the time of the bank merger. And in that letter, he informed the beneficiaries that he saw serious problems with self-interest and with self-dealing, and that he was going to resign as a co-trustee due to the position of the Atlas and Hall law firm, having a partner on the board of directors of the First City Bank, being the lawyer for the trust, the lawyer for the family, and having the McDowell State Bank as an important client. So that is in the summary judgment record.
What was the mechanism then of selecting the substitute trustee?
What's that now?
How did the substitute trustee get appointed?
That I'm not sure of. I think at that time it was the original settlor who appointed.
It was
Joe Lively. I believe. I'm not positive on that. I think that first thing we have to look at here is the fact that this is a summary judgment proceeding. The trustees brought a declaratory judgment action. The beneficiaries filed a counterclaim. In their counterclaim, they alleged several causes of action, including breach of fiduciary duty by self-dealing, by willful misconduct, and by negligence. They also eventually added claims of civil conspiracy and deceptive trade practice violations. At the summary judgment, the order that was granted stated very clearly that there would be no liability for any of the trustees on the basis of the trust code and or the trust indenture or the trust instrument. And I think that order in itself totally goes against the very language of the trust instrument when it says that a trustee shall be liable for willful misconduct. We allege that. Right off the bat, the judge simply committed error. They brought forward no summary judgment evidence that would have negated any of our elements on breach of fiduciary duty by willful misconduct.
There's no obligation for you to raise an issue as to willful misconduct other than in your pleadings?
No, sir.
All you have to do is plead it and you can defeat any summary judgment?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. It's their burden as a movement for summary judgment to negate at least one element in our cause of action. They allege that the trust or the trust code negated that element by virtue of the provision allowing retention of trust assets. But in fact, the trust code authorizes liability for willful misconduct, so that can't be the case.
Mr. Roberts, let me ask you then, what did you plead as the factual basis for your conclusion that there was willful misconduct?
We pled first that when you have a situation where a trustee, a co-trustee, is a partner in a law firm, that law firm represents the trust, that another partner in that law firm sits on the board of directors of the bank whose stock comprises almost the entire corpus of the trust. When you have that same law firm very actively involved in the drafting of that trust indenture that contains that exculpatory clause that they're relying on.
You dispute the contention that Thompson and Knight drafted the trust indenture?
They drafted it. At least they were involved in it. But the affidavit of Vernon Newhouse Jr. shows that that the Paul law firm was also actively involved in the drafting of that trust. They reviewed it. They made suggestions to it about it. So although Thompson and Knight may have done the footwork, Atlas and Hall was very actively involved. Against that backdrop, when you then have a situation where you have a merger of the McGowan State Bank with the First City State Bank, and you have the stock dropping, and you have an independent investment and analysts recommend selling that stock and the trustees refuse to do so.
That's the question I have. Where does that, who retained the investment advisor, or is this just the general knowledge that this stock should be?
Well, it's my understanding that it's in the pleadings that there was an investment analyst retained, and I don't think it's ever been disputed, and I think Mr. Cronder also said that.
By the trust?
I believe so. I believe it was by the trust, but I'm not positive on that. I'd have to refer you back to the record. I'm not absolutely sure.
So your pleadings, you say, constitute summary judgment evidence?
No, I'm not saying the pleadings constitute summary judgment evidence. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that when you plead a cause of action, it's then the movement for summary judgment burden to negate at least one of the elements of that cause of action.
Well, let me, going back to my question of what you pled, if we didn't quite get there, but I'm guessing what you're saying is the only act that you complain about is their failure to sell the stock. But you're claiming this was willful misconduct because of the arguably conflicting positions of being an advisor to a bank, the stock of which is the entire corpus of this trust for which they're the trustee. And so apparently there may be some conflict of interest there. We don't want to sell all this stock because then people will think it's bad stock, and so our bank will go down the tubes. And so inconsistent with our duty as a trustee, we're not selling stock. Now, I come forward and represent the trustee. I come forward and say, Judge, the only act they're complaining of is we didn't sell the stock. I don't care why they, I don't care what they say about why we didn't sell the stock. What we didn't do is we didn't sell stock when we should have. This document says we don't have to sell it. In fact, it says we have no liability if we don't sell it. Summary judgment.
Okay.
You're saying, well, Judge, that doesn't negate one of the elements. Well, if the only fact, the only act that you pled that gives rise to your cause of action is the failure to sell, then doesn't that end the discussion?
No, it doesn't, because we've also pled the fact of all of the various conflicts that are in operation here.
Well, again, suppose they had the worst intent of all.
That's right. Then you go exactly to willful misconduct. You have to look at the motive behind the decision to retain the stock. I mean, we can all sympathize with the trustee who gets a bad stock. And through no fault of his own, he just picks a stock and it declines in value, and that's negligence, that's poor judgment, but that's not willful misconduct. That's not a situation where you have a lot of possibility for self-dealing, where you have a lot of possibility for conflict of interest, where the decision to retain the stock isn't out of a belief that this is a good stock, that this is something that's going to rise and be a benefit to the trust. There might be other more insidious reasons operating behind the decision to retain the stock. And I think that we pled that, we stated that, and they would not be gated.
What you're saying is because of some other factors, there was a duty that arose outside the trust document. Some duty arose that required the sale of this stock, and that breach of that duty was willful misconduct under the terms of the trust nature.
Well, I think the duty is also in the trust. I think that the duty, when they say that the trustee shall be liable for his willful misconduct, that his actions cannot be motivated by willful misconduct, by intentional self-dealing or intentional, the list goes on. I think that is within the trust.
I guess I'm going back to my question. So what is the act that the trustees did or failed to do that breached their duty to the beneficiaries?
The act was, first, failing to sell each stock. I agree with that. But the act was also, when you look at that act against the backdrop of the various positions of people involved in this, I think that gives rise to a claim for willful misconduct. And I think that we pled it.
Did the set board choose all these trustees?
I'm not sure. I know he didn't choose Mr. Schwartz. I'm pretty sure about that. But I'm not sure about the rest of them. I'm sure he chose Ms. Newhouse. I'm sure he chose my client. It was initially the trustee. And I think he chose Mr. McLean because that was his personal attorney. But as Mr. Schwartz, I don't know.
Is the reference to the $1 million loss solely in the pleadings?
Yes, that's solely in the pleadings. But I don't think that's disputed. I don't think that there's been any dispute that it was $1 million loss.
What is the impact of 113.003?
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honor. 113.003. First, I agree with the Court of Appeals that it does not apply to this situation for the reason that the corpus of the trust was not initial trust corpus. It was a mutation. The merger...
If it had been the same McCallum Bank stock, would it apply?
I believe it may apply.
And exonerate liability in this case?
I'm not sure about that. I think that the general rule of law, and if you look at 113.001, I think the settlor can amend the duties and the powers of a trustee, and that the trust instrument would then control, and that would then put us back into the trust instrument over here. But in any case, the trust code was argued, and it was very much part of the summary judgment proceeding at the trial court, let alone the Court of Appeals. And I do believe that the fact that it was a mutation of the stock corpus, the trust corpus, takes it out of 113.003.
That no matter what the mutation is?
Well, just a two-for-one split.
If you look at the opinion that we refer to in Mertz by Justice Cardozo in New York and some of the other opinions, there is some factors. The stock has to be substantially different, have different characteristics. So there are some factors that I think come into play.
The Court of Appeals listed them in footnote 6 and said a different product. There's no different product here. Different.
I think in the Mertz case, one of the big points was that characteristic of the case of the stock being the type of corporation stock it was, size of the corporation, the size of the stock as a part of the trust corpus. It has to meet every single one of those standards. I think those are just some guidelines that if it meets some of those, then that can be considered a mutation.
So there could be some changes in the original stock holding that would still be initial trust corpus within the meaning of 113.03.
I think there could.
Why isn't this added to the trust?
The reason why it's not added to the trust, and this is where I think the Court of Appeals has hit on a very important point, and I think that you need to look at this way. If that blanket waiver of liability in 113.03 applies to not only initial trust corpus or a gift to the trust by the settlor, but to any trust corpus that might be added by the trustee, I think then that you really open the doors for a lot of self-dealing.
But this isn't added by the trustee.
This is, no, it's not.
This is just sitting there in a contract.
That's true, but I believe that if you interpret it the way they are interpreting it, you do open it up to the trustee. I think that the ultimate implication of that interpretation is that you open the door wide open to trustees.
How do you open the door if you exclude added by the trustee?
If you exclude added?
This was not added by the trustee. This stock here was not added by the trustee.
No, that's true. Well, the way you open the door is, you can assume that the settlor, the person that creates the trust, if he puts the trust in, that's his property. He can do with it whatever he wants. And so I think the theory has always been that a trustee shouldn't be held liable for holding on to that, because there's no possibility for self-dealing in that. But if you start saying added to some other source, then you give rise to a situation where a trustee can make deals with whomever, sell trust assets, put other assets in there which are virtually worthless.
No, that's not happening here.
No, I agree. Not doing that. But that's the implication. And I think
it won't be the implication if you draw the line on the other side. If it comes in without any action by the trustee at all, does that or does that not fit under, added to the trust under the statute?
Well, I think that's exactly why the Court of Appeals is limited to the settlor. Limited in addition to the trust corpus. The idea being that the settlor gives the trust its property. And then, for that reason, the trustee shouldn't be held liable for holding on to that property.
So why should he be liable if the trustee doesn't add to it, and the settlor's property is just changed or mutated by some action that doesn't have anything to do with anybody related to the trust?
In this case, though, it does have something to do with it. It has something to do with the trustee, and it has something to do with the banks involved.
The trustee caused the merger of the McAllen Bank and First City?
They didn't cause it, but they recommended they approved the exchange, they approved the bringing in of the First City stock. And then
if they had not approved it, what would have happened?
Well, I haven't thought that far along. I have to be honest with you.
So really, it was a formality. If the First State Bank ceased to exist, or the South State Bank ceased to exist because of the merger with First State, then anything that the trustees might have done would just have been a formality, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure that it was. Back to that letter of Mr. McLean, who was a trustee and also a partner at Allison Hall, he was very concerned about potential conflicts of interest and self-dealing, so concerned that he removed himself as a trustee at the time of this merger. I don't know that it was necessarily just a formality. At least, if it was a formality, Well, I just think that this merger certainly raised a lot of issues, at least with Mr. McLean and the Atlas and Hall law firm at that time, about self-dealing and conflicts of interest. Well, I think I'll give back the rest of my time to the court. As far as any of the other issues, I think, let me just address the issue of the ambiguity of the contract. That was not necessary to the court's holding. That was something that the Court of Appeals brought up. And I will agree that it was not pled at the trial court level, but it is not necessary to the Court of Appeals' disposition of the case. The court can decide the case based solely on the trust instrument, which gives a cause of action for willful misconduct. So again, that discussion was more in the sense of dicta than it was necessary to hold it.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
But let me at least cover these points. The exchange that we speak about occurred before Mr. Schwartz was nominated as a trustee.
Mr. Crowder, do you know how Mr. Schwartz got to be the trustee? Did the settler appoint him, or how
was that? After the letter that was referred to was written, none of the members of the firm wanted to serve. And so both Gracie and the Newhouse son gave indemnity letters to him, personal indemnity letters to get him to serve because of the many years they'd had with that firm.
Was the settler still alive at that time?
Beg pardon?
Was the settler of the trust still alive at that
time? He was. Was the time of that exchange. And Mrs. Newhouse was still alive at the time the bank went belly up. I think by that time, Dr. Newhouse had passed on. The language of the Court of Appeals, that's a fact, didn't limit it to gifts added by the settlor. It just says that language means it has to be added by additional gifts. I don't know many people that are going to make gifts to a private trust from out of the blue, but and you perhaps can read it that way. But I think that demonstrates conclusively how far the Court of Appeals went to create a cause of action because, unfortunately, the stock, had it been sold earlier, would have realized a much greater sum for the trust. No doubt about that. I want to also say to Judge Enoch, when you asked the question you did to Ms. Rankin, as to her client, the only claim ever made of misconduct was not selling the stock. She couldn't have been charged with this. The lawyer representing the firm says that stuff is directed against us. We cited cases in our briefs, and sent one recently to the court, in which what happened here is not self-dealing. If there's a clause in the trust that permits exchanging between husbands, wives, partners, so long as there's no pocket lining by the trustee. And that's all. And we negatized that. As it came down to the wire, the only thing that they have ever said what constituted misconduct was the failure to sell the stock in this deteriorating market. In hindsight, it would have been fine had they done so. And perhaps we wouldn't be here today, and I wouldn't become employed. But at least I say that this is a situation where if the legislature can't with what it did, and the trustee tanks can't do what they did to these documents and exculpate liability without having to be exposed to the world by any kind of misconduct, then we might as well wipe out the statute, the trust code, and the whole work.
Mr.
I conclude once again on the...
Mr. Conger, excuse me. The, Mr. Roberts, in answer to my question, was saying that if the reasons for retaining the stock are not proper reasons, that that also constitutes willful misconduct. And it's in the context, well, here I'm, my firm advises a bank. The bank's in financial trouble. My firm also has a trustee of a trust that owns a chunk of stock in that bank. I'm faced with a potential dilemma. If I sell a large block of stock in that bank, do I send a signal to people in the community that the bank's going under, or do I retain the stock in the hopes that the panic will survive and the bank will survive? Now, take that and assume that that's the reason that the trustee chooses not to sell the stock in this stock in this bank for this trust. Mr. Roberts would say those factors in the determination not to sell overcome the exculpation of the liability for failure to sell by then saying that it was an improper motive in not selling and was not to have been protected by this indenture. You can see that the motive of the trustee in the selling or not selling, in this case of not selling, overrides the exculpation of the failure to sell?
Well, I conceptually can as to Mr. Morris Adams, but not as to Gracie. She has no collateral interest in it. In other words, that's why when they finished up the hearing below, they said, Judge, you've cut the leg on all the issues. We don't have any issue of fact. And now they don't say that as to it applying to Morris Adams and my clients. What your reason? I say as to that. There was not any suggestion. There was a motivation that was evil, wrong, or intended to injure the trust. And so it is that I'm not going to tell Your Honor that there couldn't be a motivation that would make a trustee liable beyond the statute or beyond the trust doctrine. Because historically, in trust code, trust law, if the trustees act in what is defined as bad faith or towards an intent to purposely injure the trust itself, then as to that, that is an obligation of a trustee that can be held a liability notwithstanding the trust code. Thank you very much, Mr.
Other questions? Thank you. Foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and that concludes the oral arguments for the day. Marshall will now adjourn the court.
Now, this is 25. OEA, OEA.